Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Our special guest today is Rachel Dollar. Rachel is recognized as one of the nation's leading experts in the mortgage lending industry. An attorney, Ms. Dollar is the editor of the acclaimed public service industry website, Mortgage Fraud Blog, which is at www.mortgagefraudblog.com, and one of my favorite websites. And it's committed to raising awareness of the growing problem associated with mortgage fraud. Rachel's a certified mortgage banker, and she's been repeatedly named by Inman News as one of the 100 most influential real estate leaders. Rachel, welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me, Bruce. I always relish the opportunity to educate on this topic.
Years ago, I watched a show called Scared Straight, where teenagers that were getting out of line got to spend basically a few hours in prison associating with people that they would be next to. And in a way, I think your website does something like that. I send people there often because they bring up solutions to real estate problems they think are tricky, and then I send them to your website and I find out that it's got a 5 to 8 year sentence behind it. So do you find that website is really proving to be a deterrent for people?
We hope it's a deterrent. We initially started it as a way to get information to lenders who lend on a national space, even though they are geographically located in certain areas of the country, so that they understand what fraud schemes are happening. But we have found that it's very educational to real estate professionals, to mortgage brokers. I mean, it's often used also as a kind of gossip rag for who in the industry is getting in trouble.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different ways. But when you talked about Scared Straight, I just thought that was a little interesting because mortgage fraud is maybe backwards. We see a lot of people coming out of prison and starting to commit mortgage fraud because they learn about it in prison.
Really?
Yeah.
I would have thought it would have been preventative. Matter of fact, I wondered how much recovery was done. You know, you're chasing somebody that's going to go to jail and you give them a $2 million fine. I don't know how much of that you're going to collect, but I wonder how much you don't have to collect because somebody next to him went, wow, I would have never thought that could happen.
Well, in the wider community, yes. But in the prison system and for hardened criminals, mortgage fraud is actually an easier and probably less risky way to make money criminally than some of the other ways. I mean, no one's going to come after you with a gun for committing mortgage fraud, whereas drug-related crimes often involve those types of violent reactions.
Okay. What is the definition of fraud?
Of mortgage fraud?
Yeah.
Fraud.
Just mortgage
fraud. Mortgage fraud is any misrepresentation or omission that is used to defraud a lender into lending more money than they would have or on different terms.
And you said something about new schemes, and I guess that term surprised me in a way because I thought the idea of new would only be to the person that just thought they dreamt something up, and yet the FBI may have had the playbook for 30 years. So are there new ways to do stuff?
We see new twists more than new schemes.
Okay.
You know, there's basic schemes that people utilize, and they utilize them over and over. Flipping doesn't really change. But now we've kind of got flopping, which is coming in on the short sale side and undervaluing property and then increasing it, you know, on the flip side when they turn around and sell it. So it's the same basic scheme because you have to take something and get it for less than it's worth and sell it for more than it's worth in order to make money on it. But it's just they find different ways to get around the controls that are put in place in the lending institutions. And that's a constant process. We constantly see the fraudster shifting the way they do things in order to get through controls.
What's interesting is that I've basically made a living for a long time doing flipping.
Mm-hmm.
Flipping it legitimately to where you mm-hmm. buy something below market, you fix it up and repair it. And to have it tossed in there as, you know, a scheme, it's difficult to hear but I understand it. In other words, it's mm-hmm. flipping that you're referring to is really sending it off to another price level without any reason for that to have occurred, and then maybe it happens repetitively?
Yes. And flipping, of course, flipping by itself is absolutely legal, and it's the American dream.
I'm relieved.
Capitalism at work.
I'm relieved to hear that.
But illegal flipping is where a fraudulent appraisal is used, where the value of the property is not supported. And we often see it in large schemes. And, for instance, we'll see properties that are picked up for $6,000 and sold in a simultaneous transaction for $50,000 or $60,000 or $70,000 with bank financing, that are sold to a person who was paid for the use of their credit, who then defaults.
And that's, that term is known as a straw buyer.
Yes.
What's interesting is, again, I come up once in a while in conversations, just I might be exercising or whatever, and somebody thinks they've dreamed up something. And, you know, and a straw buyer is one of them, where they have an easy way out. They can't sell something, but they got somebody they can pay. And they really, they have no recognition that it's wrong and that it might even be something that will send them to jail.
These are complicated financial transactions. And I'll tell you that I even have lawyers that call me up and who say, you know, I've run across this. My client wants to do this or this. And it doesn't sound right, but I can't figure out what's wrong with it.
Okay.
And so sometimes you have to dissect them to come up with what it is. And for the populace out there, just consumers or even real estate professionals, a lot of times it's hard to figure out exactly what it is that's wrong with the transaction.
Does it usually take a team to pull off a successful scheme?
Depends on what it is.
Okay, so let's say you have...
If it's a fraud-for-profit type scheme where they're out there and they're going to, you know, make money on 100 houses and they are taking money out of the escrows and diverting it, you need several people. You have to have your escrow agent or your closing agent involved, or sometimes known in the industry or your industry maybe even as a friendly closer.
Okay.
You have a lot of times a ringleader out there, sometimes an investor. You have the real estate mortgage broker and the real estate agent a lot of times involved. So there are several different layers of involvement. An appraiser, generally.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're talking about a situation where somebody is just lying to get into a mortgage, you know, you don't necessarily need to have other people involved in it.
Well, and what's interesting about what you just mentioned, the FBI report that came out in probably 2009, I read it word for word, and they had mm-hmm. very different opinion, fraud for ownership and fraud for profit.
Mm-hmm.
Fraud for ownership, is that pursued?
Not generally.
Okay.
We generally see fraud for ownership or fraud for housing is only pursued when there is there's something else at work. We see it, prosecutions for mortgage fraud for housing when there is terrorism involved. We see it when it's public officials that are involved in it. There's usually some other motivation when the government brings those charges.
But in general, an owner-occupant is much safer committing fraud than somebody that's an investor. Would that be fair to say?
Yes.
Okay.
At the same point in time, though, it really depends on whether or not it's discovered. One of the reasons why they're, quote, safer is because it's more difficult to discover it, because you will have an isolated incident of default rather than a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if you have a mortgage broker who's out there and who decides that they want to get a group, an ethnic group, into homes and really help them. And I've seen this in some of the Hispanic communities where they'll have a Hispanic mortgage broker who goes in and he's just helping people, helping them get into homes and live the American dream, falsifies their employment records, falsifies their credit histories, and puts them all into homes. Now, if he did it one time, that loan defaulted, you probably never know there was anything wrong with it. But because he's got 100 of them that he just did and 90 of them default, when the lenders go in and they start looking at default patterns, they notice it out of that particular mortgage broker, and then they can target their audit. So that's why it's more likely to get picked up when there's a professional involved.
When you do end up with one of these multiple people schemes, is there any one party that seems to end up being more guilty than the others?
More guilty.
No, well, in other words, well, they're all guilty, but more punishable. So you have a mortgage broker orchestrating an appraiser, etc. At the end of the day, who goes to jail, I guess?
The escrow agent generally goes to jail because the escrow agent is touching the money and if they are involved, they are oftentimes falsifying HUD-1 settlement statements.
Or they're
lying about where the money went.
There you go. Okay, I didn't.
You oftentimes have a mortgage broker who will also be indicted or go to prison, and that's because of the falsification of documents again.
What was interesting?
Surprisingly enough, appraisers are the ones who walk away the most.
Okay. In 2006, we held an event where we had 400 people that were basically investors in the audience, and I interviewed a mortgage broker in front of them, and I asked eventually this question, you know, the stated income, where did that number come from? And she honestly said in front of the 400 group of people, oh, we just made it up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty fearless statement. In other words, that's just common. And most of that was stated income for ownership. And so, you know, it's interesting. I think the problem that we have right now certainly has been created by the greed of the owner that probably wasn't capable of buying the next level house. And yet it seems to be the least punishable thing. Maybe it's because there's too many people. That could be part of it.
And the fact that it's not being criminally prosecuted is not to say that the lending industry is not looking at it, or that government agencies are not necessarily looking at it. So there could be repercussions coming through some of the administrative agencies.
Okay.
Through Fannie or Freddie, or through the FDIC, or through, you know, various different parties.
One of the things that struck me when I read the SARS report was the length of time, I guess I'll call it shelf life, that some of these things have. 33% of all cases that were eventually brought existed for 4 years.
Is that the SARS?
Yes, in the SARS report. So there was a length of time that before, you know, when the activity was done and before. This is my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there was quite a length of time before somebody actually knew they had been caught.
Well, before it was reported.
Yes.
Before
it was reported. Okay.
So that's why I asked whether it was SARS or whether it was FBI investigations. So with suspicious activity reports, it just wasn't discovered. And a lot of suspicious activity reports are being filed right now around the repurchase process. So where the lenders are going in and auditing files and discovering a basis for repurchase, they're also discovering criminal conduct.
Okay, when you're
and filing SARS as a result of that.
Let's clarify just for the audience. The repurchase is basically when somebody that is kind of a guarantor looks at the file and said, well, wait a minute, you guys didn't do it this correctly.
Not necessarily even a guarantor. So it can be mortgage insurance.
Okay.
Companies that notice and they'll rescind coverage in doing these investigations, they'll rescind their insurance coverage. And they'll discover the fraudulent activity and alert the lender, who then files a suspicious activity report. But there's also, within the loan industry, there's a lot of talk about the securitizations and the sale of loans up into the secondary market. Those secondary market purchasers have the right to send the loan back if there are certain problems with it. And fraud is one of those issues.
Okay.
So if they discover fraud within the loan, they can send the loan back to the originator, the mortgage lender that originally made the loan, and require that they buy back the loan, give them the money back.
Okay. Stated income loans necessitated a lot of times exaggerating income, and now you have a loan mod that probably necessitates minimizing income. So is that fraud?
Yes, that's fraud as well. And it's not always minimizing income to get a loan mod. A lot of people are inflating income in order to qualify for loan mods. It really depends on what the situation is. Some people can't qualify because they don't have enough money. Some can't qualify because they have too much.
Okay.
And that's the interesting thing when you see certain homeowners going to the loan mod companies that instead of asking the questions are giving the information.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of saying how much money do you make, the response is this is how much money you need to make in order to qualify. And then it's kind of like when they used to alter applications in order to qualify for the loan. Now they're making up the information to qualify for the modification. They did eliminate stated income modifications, though, which was going on for a while.
Okay. What goes on in short sales that might be fraudulent?
short sale, the short sale process tends to be rife with fraud. There's actually an interesting conviction out of a lending institution this last week where one of the Taylor Bean and Whitaker loss mitigation employees was lying to the bank about the amount of the sales, and they were sending the payoff checks in through their own company, cashing them and sending a portion into Taylor Bean. So that was kind of an interesting inside short sale scam.
I read that, and it was they were basically netting something like 10%, right? They were paying off 80% when it was really 90% or something along that line.
Yeah.
That's pretty involved.
I thought that was pretty audacious. That's one of the, the more audacious one I've seen.
Yeah. That now, the one that I, and again, these people, they dream this up as if, well, this is a good idea. Neighbors, both neighbors bought a new house. You know, they owe 500 grand on a 300 grand house, and they were going to short sale it to each other and then exchange ownership later.
Mm-hmm.
That just sounds so clean to them somehow. That can't be good either, right?
No, it can't. When you already have agreements in place that aren't disclosed, you're generally asking for trouble. It's what I always ask people when they come up with ideas is, why aren't you just telling the bank what you're doing?
Well, you know, that's that would be almost too much to ask. It's interesting, the investors. That was I remember giving the talk. We speak to a lot of investor groups, and I had read the FBI report, and people that were buying and flipping short sales were referred to as perpetrators, which probably isn't a good word. And so I mentioned that in front of this audience, and about half of them about dropped off their chair because I said, you have to tell the lender what it is you intend to do, and I think for how much, and then you buy it. Everybody knows the whole score. Well, you know, the comment is, well, they would never agree to it. Well, then you can't do it.
And that's the exact question, is why are you not telling them the truth? Because they wouldn't agree to it. Well, then doesn't that tell you?
Yeah, there's a problem.
Isn't that your answer right there? If your answer is they wouldn't do it if I told them the truth, that's the answer. But with short sales, you know, if they're purchasing property at a short sale and then they're going to fix it up and sell it, or they're buying it to live in it, there's nothing wrong with that. It's only when there's a deal in place, especially the leaseback deals to the homeowners,
yes,
that it really becomes an issue. And the lenders are actually now requiring arm's length affidavits in most of the transactions. And I've seen convictions over when actually in the case in Connecticut, it was two real estate agents and they signed arm's length affidavits as a part of the short sale process. Well, they had been the bank's real estate agents, and they had already done an auction, and they had a sales contract in place at a higher amount.
I think I remember reading that on your site, and it wasn't an egregious difference.
Mm-mm.
As I recall, it was something like 30 grand.
Yep.
And
it doesn't have to be.
Right.
It's
the intent.
Fraud.
And I think that is a misconception, too, that you think, okay, well, this is a little amount of money. So that's no one's going to bother chasing this one down. And that isn't true.
Mm-hmm. And we often work with the authorities to prosecute some of those smaller cases and bring the smaller cases to their attention, because that's how we make an example that we can point to on other cases. I love the clean little cases where somebody is convicted of falsifying or inflating income on a stated income loan, and there's nothing else involved in it. That's my favorite case, because I can point at that and I can say, look, you can go to jail for this. And I've had other cases where people have said, you know, send me to one case where there's a prosecution for just inflated stated income. If you send them to anything where they also falsified down payments, that's the whole justification. Well, they were falsifying down payments too.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not illegal to inflate stated income. So those clean cases where there's one issue and it's a small issue and there's not a lot of money involved, they're my favorite one.
Okay, well, this one is near and dear to my heart. We buy at Trustee Sales about 100 houses a year, and about one of 10, somebody decides that they have earned the right to take their kitchen and anything else that they want.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been court cases that said, guess what, guys, that's fraud, that's a felony, or that's a problem, you get to go to jail for that?
There are some cases pending in Arizona on the stripping issue. It is difficult to get criminal law enforcement involved in it, but the lending industry will often pursue the borrower in those cases because it is a violation of the trust deed. And it is actually theft because the house now belongs to the lender and you're stealing.
Yes.
And once that foreclosure sale has taken place, the appliances, the wiring, the copper tubing, it all belongs to the lender, and so it is theft. And I know in Arizona that they are prosecuting some of those cases.
Okay. Well, you know, here's a problem for a trustee sale buyer is we don't have a trust deed that anybody signed. So they're not in breach of that. They're just in breach of stealing my stuff. And I guess I want to also ask, and very, very different laws in states. It seems like if you were in Texas, you probably would have a lot harder time pulling off that stuff than in California.
As far as stripping houses?
Well, yeah, just the ability to enter and document a condition of a property. In California, it is not really that easy to say, I want to come in and photo this place that I just bought for cash. And I know I know you're going to have, you know, be 3 or 4 months or 6 months, depending who you know, or how long you get to stay. But it's very difficult to actually get the right to do that.
You're not going to necessarily have the right to do that, but it still is a theft situation. The issue, I guess, is proving whether it happened before or after, but they would have to testify that the stuff had been, someone had broken in and stolen all the copper tubing out of the house, and then the question would be, why didn't you file a police report?
Yeah.
So there is the waste provision, which is civil and which exists as far as I know in every state.
Yes, I've heard definitely that. But then once again, of course, you get a judgment that may be very difficult to collect on and expensive to pursue.
Absolutely.
But criminally, it would be nice to be able to go to your website pretty soon and go, hey, we can make a copy of that and put it in the mailer to people if they are contemplating taking their stuff.
Yeah, well, I'll make sure that if we see a stripping conviction, that we'll get it up there for you.
I would love to do that. Are there any new things for 2011 that are new schemes that are emerging that might be different than the past?
We're seeing basically the same things going on. An increase in short sale and flipping frauds, continued modification frauds. It's the same groups of people that are vulnerable and that are being taken advantage of.
One of the groups that definitely get taken advantage of is someone that's elderly, and we've got about a minute and a half left, but there are groups of people that literally will just deed a property away from an owner and do a loan or do a sale.
Mm-hmm.
That boggles my mind that somebody would be that blatant. But is that, I guess common's not the right word, but that happens a fair amount?
It does happen a fair amount, especially in the larger fraud for property schemes. People who are out there to steal are going to steal the easiest way they can. And we do see quite a lot of that.
And what's the penalty phase? Basically, for somebody, and are they, and with a minute left, are they sent to a cushy prison, or is this serious time?
It's serious time, but it is white collar time.
Okay.
We have seen some very long sentences handed down, 30 years. We've seen 50. I've seen 100. So there have been some really stiff penalties associated with mortgage fraud, and as the judiciary becomes more educated, I expect to see increasing. We've actually seen a doubling in the average sentence for mortgage fraud over the last couple of years.
And yet mortgage fraud percentage-wise is up year over year.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm sure it's a big problem. You have on your website $2 billion in fines, 5,000 years in jail, and you're looking at something around 850 cases that are waiting for jail sentencing. So this is a serious problem.
Yes, it is.
Rachel, thank you so much for joining us. Rachel Dollar, and her website again, mortgagefraudblog.com. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.